This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about a new petition for clemency before Donald Trump. It involves the case of the Silk Road founder, Ross Ulbricht, who's been in prison for 4 years. He faces a double life sentence. We take a look at the attorney-client privilege. We'll talk with an expert about the problems of making exceptions to that privilege, as in the FBI search of Donald Trump's attorney's home and office. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. 4 years ago, a jury found that then 29-year-old Ross Ulbricht was guilty on charges related to operating a dark website called the Silk Road. It sold, among many other things, illicit drugs. The case was a high-profile one, and Ross has come to be known by many as the face of the dark web. He was convicted on 7 charges, including a so-called kingpin charge. And now retired Judge Catherine Forrest imposed 2 life sentences and 40 years. Ross is a young, nonviolent, first-time offender. He wasn't convicted of selling drugs or illegal items himself, but rather of creating an e-commerce website that others chose to use for that purpose. No victim was named at trial, and prosecutors had not even sought such a long sentence. Corruption, abuse, evidence tampering, and multiple violations of Ross's rights cast serious doubt on the legitimacy of the conviction and sentence. In a 2016 appeal, defense attorneys outlined a litany of improprieties and abuses in the investigation and trial. Perhaps most serious was that the court precluded information about 2 corrupt federal agents investigating the Silk Road, who are now both serving prison sentences on corruption charges. In 2018, the Supreme Court denied to consider the case. Today, Ross's mother, Lynn Ulbricht, joins us to talk about a petition for clemency to President Donald Trump. Lynn Ulbricht, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Well, it's such a pleasure to be here, Heidi. It's always good to talk to you.
Lynn, I can't believe it, but it's been 2 years since we last spoke on the radio about Ross's case. You filed a writ of cert before the Supreme Court last year and were denied. Now you're filing a petition for clemency. Talk about the theory about that before we get into the details of the case.
An online petition that's got over 191,000 signatures now on change.org. It's not the official Department of Justice petition. We have not filed that yet because there's still the 2255 that is coming before the district court.
For our audience, Lynn, what's the 2255?
Sure. Yeah, and it's also called a habeas petition, and it is basically it's a last-ditch effort that's asking the district court for a new trial, a new sentencing, some kind of relief here because of various, mostly ineffective assistance of counsel with the trial and attorney. So they decide if you did get ineffective assistance, and if they decide you did and the government doesn't win their argument because you have to battle it out with the prosecutors, the judge has the power to give you a new trial, a new sentencing, some kind of relief. So that is in process now. It was filed at the end of June. But meanwhile, we have this petition on change.org. It's not, like I say, an official petition, but it's a PR tool in a way. It's showing the kind of support that clemency for Ross has, and this is a worldwide grassroots effort. So it's a good tool for making the case for clemency, that there's a lot of support for it.
Okay, Lynn, now there are several aspects that inform the request for clemency, and it's quite a textbook case of if something can go wrong, it went wrong in this case. Let's talk first about the multiple website administrators. Can you give us a brief summary of that?
There is lots and lots of anecdotal evidence that there were several people running Silk Road under the moniker Dread Pirate Roberts, or DPR. And even the name Dread Pirate Roberts comes from The Princess Bride, in which the character would pass on his title to a new guy. Right. Everything was anonymous. There was never a witness that said that Ross was Dread Pirate Roberts at all. There was never a live witness to say that who it was. But it came up in trial, and that there was a high-level administrator who told the prosecution that he was conferring with Dread Pirate Roberts, and they decided on a digital handshake, kind of a cue. So that the next time they talked, because everybody knew there were many of them, that he would know it was that guy. When DPR, for short, came on the next time, he didn't know the cue. He didn't know the handshake, which indicates to me that there were more than one, at least, maybe multiple. This was, at the last minute, precluded from the jury knowing. Like, it was not allowed to be told. Even that shred of doubt was not allowed to be brought forth to the jury. Then after, and there's more, there's a lot more anecdotal evidence in deep web. He interviews high-level admins who say, oh, yeah, of course, there was lots of them. In fact, if I wanted something and I couldn't get it from one DPR, I'd just go to another DPR.
Oh, I didn't know
and
that.
And that's the way the Internet is. Yeah, it's I believe that's in deep web.
The
documentary, yeah. Really the most fair and interesting and objective documentary out there, I would guess. I haven't seen all of them. Curtis Green, who is a character in all of this drama and who has said, yeah, I was DPR. I acted as DPR. So who else did? Kind of thing. And then, just to cinch it, when Ross was in solitary confinement, evidence was found post-trial that Dread Pirate Roberts signed in to the Silk Road Forum. The forum had not been taken down. The marketplace had been taken down. The forum was still up, and someone using the Dread Pirate Roberts account signed in. We didn't discover it until after trial because of the being buried in data, basically, which is something apparently the government does to people, where
right.
I think it was around 4 terabytes. I mean, if it were paper, you would be crushed to death under it. So, of course, it's impossible to wade through all that, especially with there were so many roadblocks trying to get it done.
Lynn, you've raised a really critical point for computer-related cases. This burying of defendants in electronic evidence is not unique to Ross's case. And
not at all.
The problem
That's
is
right.
When you're being detained, you have very limited access to a computer. Under the best of circumstances, it would take months, if not years, to wade through all that data to help mount a proper defense with the attorney.
Mm-hmm.
Ross
exactly.
didn't get to do that.
No, not at all.
Now, let's talk about the judge's denial of bail during trial, refusal to turn over the witness list, and what other ways did Judge Forrest really prejudice Ross's case?
Okay, well, the bail judge was a different judge. It was a magistrate judge. I believe his name was Fox. Yeah, I mean, there were 70 letters to him, which I seriously doubt he read, from the questions he asked. And that was, according to our lawyer, who's been in practice for 30 years, a record number for a bail hearing.
You mean letters of support from people saying,
saying, please grant him bail, he's not a flight risk, oh, so sorry. He's not a flight risk. And we even raised $1 million in pledges from people who put up their homes, their life savings, because they know Ross, they trust him, and they knew that he wouldn't flee and leave them penniless or whatever. They trusted Ross enough, which says a lot about his character. There was no violent charges. However, the night before the bail hearing, at the very last minute, they brought up these murder-for-hire allegations, which they never did charge him with. The Southern District brought it up and never charged him with. But right before bail, the attorney didn't even know about it. He didn't have a chance to confer with Ross about it, and they used it to say he was dangerous and shouldn't get bail. And then they didn't even indict him for it 2 months later.
And that was one of the issues that you tried to raise on appeal.
That did come up at appeal. Well, what happened was the judge Forrest, who is retired, but Judge Catherine Forrest, even though the murder for hire allegations were never proven, they were never charged at trial, they were never ruled on by a jury, she referred to them as if they were fact and used them to justify her draconian, outrageous, barbaric sentence of double life plus 40 years for a nonviolent first-time offender. The appellate court didn't seem to mind this. Now, by the time it got to the Supreme Court, that was argued because it is a violation of the Sixth Amendment, which protects the rights of the accused from a rogue judge or prosecutor, and says, no, it's a jury who decides these things, not 12 people, not one judge. And so it was a direct violation of the Sixth Amendment to have her bring in uncharged allegations, and yet she did that.
Lynn, also, wasn't the jury sequestered during the trial?
No, they weren't sequestered. They were not identified. So they were kind of, you could say, anonymized, where they were juror 1, 2, 3. From what I understand, this is unusual and could have sent a signal to them that, well, we want to keep you anonymous because this person's dangerous. So that did happen, but they were not sequestered. She threatened to sequester them if we didn't. There were protesters outside the courthouse, peaceful, just holding signs, and she threatened that if they were not gone the next day, that she would take action.
I've never heard of a judge saying the protesters needed to leave.
Yeah. And she, yeah, well, she's, yeah, that would be Catherine Forrest. And, they had every First Amendment right to be in front of a courthouse expressing their opinion, but she didn't like it. First of all, the lawyer said, we've got to do this. If he is sequestered, it will be very prejudicial against him. The jury will be upset. They'll have to go to, be taken to a secret place and, all this stuff. And it indicates, it's like what you do with very dangerous criminals.
So, like El Chapo.
Yeah, like El Chapo, who got a lighter sentence than Ross.
Amazing. Now, Lynn, mm-hmm. I want to talk about some of the misconduct by the individuals involved. Law enforcement. Our listeners may not remember some of the drama on that end.
Sure. Well, of course, there were the two agents that are now in prison.
Right.
Karl Mark Force, the DEA agent, and Sean Bridges, a Secret Service agent who was also on assignment from the NSA. And they used their access to the site to steal money from people, as well as, who knows, they had the ability to act as DPR. They had and other aliases. They had passwords, keys. They could change anything in the chats and set up anyone. And the marketplace, they could go into anything, basically the keys to the kingdom. This was not permitted to be known to the jury. And in fact, the prosecution lied to the judge and said, oh, we can't have this known because it will tip off these guys that they're under investigation. And then it came out that they knew they were under investigation. They'd been interviewed by law enforcement 8 months previously, as well as the fact that they did not reveal the identity of Sean Bridges to the judge or the defense until after trial it came out.
And what did Sean Bridges do?
Yeah, well, he stole a bunch of money, and we don't know what he did. He was kind of the tech expert behind it.
Investigating.
And, they were both investigators at the core of the investigation, yes.
Right.
But they had total access.
Yeah, I would think that in the usual way of doing things, this taint of the trial could have been grounds for a mistrial, hung jury.
Yeah. But that jury didn't know about it at all. There was any reference to it, the prosecution would leap up and object, 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 and even a bleak reference to an alias that they used. And the judge allowed that. And the appeal court said, well, how is it exculpatory? Two corrupt agents have a run of the site, stealing money, could change evidence that the jury saw.
Exactly.
We don't know. We weren't. Couldn't pursue it.
They could have manipulated things.
Seriously?
Right. Talking about that injustice, talk about some of the sentences that other related parties got.
Well, just to sum it up, it's the longest sentence that anyone else related to the case got is 10 years who has been accused of being the biggest drug seller on Silk Road. And by the way, Ross was never accused of selling drugs at all. This is Jan Slomp. He has the same offense level as Ross in the Bureau's, you know, way of rating people and stuff. It's the same. He got 10 years. And it goes down from there. To me, the most shocking one is after Silk Road was taken down, an immediate copycat site, Silk Road 2, came up. The government called it identical, except bigger. They sold more drugs and in a month, had more listings, knew exactly what they were doing, and which, by the way, when Ross created this site, he had no idea it was going to get to be what it was. It was
right.
Like a whole free market thing. Obviously, these people knew exactly what it was. Blake Benthal, the main guy, he has no prison time at all. It just came out through, I believe, Vice or someone discovered all he's getting is 2 years back taxes that he has to pay. Shocking. And we're supposed to have equal sentences for equal, charges. That's the law. And that's what this guy got. And then the other guy under him got 5 years, but that was in the UK. And, of course, other countries are much less draconian than ours.
Exactly. We're especially hard on computer-related offenses. Now, that points to, I think, how this country prosecutes creativity and innovation online. So they saw Ross as kind of the genius creator of this idea. And he was punished for having a great idea that took off, as you said, even beyond his wildest dreams.
Oh, way beyond.
Now, didn't Chuck Schumer call for his prosecution?
I don't know. What he said was, in an open letter to Eric Holder, who was Attorney General at the time, congratulations, you got your man. As if he's guilty pre-trial.
Yeah.
He's saying this as a senator of New York, in New York, where the jury's coming from. So basically, the senator of New York said that Ross was guilty pre-trial.
Right.
I see this as a problem. We have, presumption of innocence, supposedly, and that's very prejudicial, in my opinion. It was also Chuck Schumer, he kind of called attention to this whole thing and got everybody motivated in law enforcement to be the ones that got DPR. There was a lot of motivation for that. And he said, we need to take down Bitcoin, and we need to get this guy. What happened was a few months before the takedown of Silk Road, the NSA, it came out in Snowden papers, it was secret, but they came out, Snowden revealed it, that the NSA was urgently tracking Bitcoin users a few months before, Ross's arrest and the takedown of the Silk Road 1. And, of course, if you're tracking Bitcoin users in those days, the only place you would go is Silk Road. I mean, it was the only marketplace using Bitcoin, the only proof of use of Bitcoin as a currency. So, I think the technology was very threatening. And they even said, you were the first to do this, and you're going to pay the price for being the first. And there's no law saying the first person has a worse sentence than the second person. And, in fact, it doesn't even make sense.
That's a good point.
The second person knows exactly what they're getting into. The first person's innovating, and he was a kid. He was a very passionate kid. Little too much zeal, perhaps, but the intentions were all good.
Right.
And it wasn't to be a drug kingpin. It was to have a free market.
Right.
It was private.
Libertarian views. Now, really what he did was he hit on the Holy Trinity, Bitcoin, Tor Anonymizer, and the dark web. That hit all the buttons for law enforcement.
Yeah.
And their fear is of, quote, going dark, not being able to have access to communications. Now, Lynn, let's talk for a minute about Ross's current situation. He has moved facilities, correct?
That's correct. In January, he did.
And he started out at a rather intimidating federal facility. Tell us a bit about that.
Okay, well, he actually started out in New York in a transitional facility where everybody goes to be tried by the Southern District. So he was there for 4 years almost, which is longer, but he wanted to be, he actually asked for permission because he wanted to be able to work on his case with his lawyers and who were based in New York, and he doesn't have email. He's been deprived of email. Other inmates have it. He does not because it's an internet crime. In any case, he was then sent to USP Florence, Colorado, which is one of the most violent prisons, high security, because of his life sentence. His actual security score is so low, he would be in a camp. They were even like, when he came, they go, what are you doing in here? You know, it's like, what the heck? And it's because of his sentence. So Ross, who has never been violent, has never inflicted any bodily harm on any other person, gets thrust into an environment that is most violent gangs and dangerous criminals in the system. It's a step down from the supermax, and had to deal with that for a year and a half. What happened was he finally was being pressured with another person, beat up someone. It's kind of a rite of passage sort of thing that's expected, and he wouldn't do it because he's. And later, he even talked to the guy. He said, I'm not a snitch. My cellmate framed me. And it's like, Ross didn't even know the guy. And it was like, he's like, no, I'm not violent. I'm not going to do your thing. That put him in extreme danger because you do not say no. And actually, he is in danger if he's put ever in a regular USP again because it's known.
So word spreads from facility to facility.
Absolutely.
Now, were there a lot of white supremacists in that facility?
There were some, yes. There, yeah. It wasn't all, I mean, all the white people there are not white supremacists, but there were plenty of them, yeah.
So are there gangs? That gang related?
Yeah, it's very gang heavy.
Right.
Well, yeah, it's actually expected of any white person, apparently, but in this particular thing. But yeah, there's different gangs. They're all very gang heavy. Yeah, and of course Ross wasn't in a gang.
So where did he go after that?
Yeah, so protective custody was basically 3.5 months in a 8x10 metal box with no windows, sitting there, no books except the Bible. They allow religious books, and that's it. And so then, thankfully, he was transferred to USP Tucson, which is for people who are in danger in the system for various reasons, and it's not violent. So it's night and day. I mean, he was even going through kind of a post-traumatic stress come-down, you know, from being on alert constantly at the other place, because you never know if you're going to get stabbed, beaten up, there's going to be a riot, it's constant adrenaline. So now he said it's just better in every way there, in terms of it's not dangerous. I mean, so that's better. And he's working on his case still, the 2255 mainly, you know, pursuing other things. He doesn't watch TV. He's pretty productive with his time. You know, he joined a band so he could, you know, play music, which is a good outlet for him. It's prison. He wants out of there desperately, but it's not a dangerous prison. And that is tremendously better.
And is he permitted more visitors than in the other facility?
No, it's the same, but so it's every weekend he can have visitors.
Lynn, let's go back to the online petition before we talk about the official one that's going to be delivered to Donald Trump. When do you actually switch from the online to the in-person one?
Well, we hope to be able to call Donald Trump's attention to the online one. My goal is 500,000. If we can get to 500,000 or even 250,000, I feel like we can say use that as part of our sales pitch for this report that's out there. We've been told by and actually retained a pardon attorney in D.C. who said, you know, I really can't do anything till the 2255 is resolved as far as going to the Department of Justice.
Right.
But the truth is that the president has an absolute right and the privilege of pardoning someone anytime he feels like it for any reason. And I believe he recently did pardon not pardon, but commute the sentence of someone who hadn't even gone through appeals. So it's not a hard and fast rule or law. It's just kind of what you do. And the truth is, with the Department of Justice, I know people who've had their paperwork in there for years. You know, oh, yeah, okay, put that in the stack with other petitions. So we felt like, at least for now, since it's not advised to put an official one, that we would do the online one just to show support. And we really, really please people, if you think it's wrong to have a life sentence for a nonviolent first-time offender who's remorseful, who is now much more mature, who has grown out of this, to spend the rest of his life in a cage, if you think that's a little much, please sign the petition at freeross.org and help us get to 500,000.
I signed it, Lynn.
Thank you, Heidi.
Lynn, why would Donald Trump be interested in this case?
Well, you know, I feel like, A, it's unjust, and I think that he could be made to see that if he heard the real story behind it. He himself is an entrepreneur. He understands, I think, probably understands how a young man could have a great idea and have it get out of control, just have that empathy. I also think it politically it could be advantageous to him. There are so many supporters, and we were talking about almost 200,000 right now, people come up to me all the time and say, if Trump commuted Russia's sentence, I'd vote for him, and otherwise I probably won't. And Bitcoin people, the Libertarian Party officially came out for clemency for Ross. A lot of libertarians have said it. Just, it would, I think, be a huge signal for mercy. And I think he's interested in that. He's signaled that he is interested in that. And so we want to make the case that Ross is a perfect candidate. He would never offend again. There's no risk of that whatsoever. You know, to give him a chance and to get the applause of people all around the world for that kind of action of justice and mercy.
Lynn, there's one point that is important to cover because it impacts the law's relationship with privacy and internet security, and that's namely how the authorities say they got control of or access to the IP address of the Silk Road.
Right.
Can you sort of summarize that? And that was why so many people were dismayed, not just for Ross, but really for the impact this might have on search and seizure. Can you talk about that?
Totally. And it went to the Supreme Court. And we actually thought we were going to get some traction at the Supreme Court because it has come up before them before. It was up at the time with cell phones, and but they just didn't kicked the can down the road. Basically, it's something that really needs to be addressed, because right now the government can, in secret, without a warrant, without probable cause, delve into all of our internet activity and history and information at their will and use it against us however they wish, which opens up the door to blackmailing officials, to pursuing political enemies with information that might be, you know, compromising or whatever. It's based on an antiquated doctrine called the third-party doctrine it's based on the dial telephone. This was ruled on four decades ago when telephones were telephones and not little computers that we carry around and that have access to all kinds of relevant information. But the law has not updated to protect our rights and privacy. And Sandra Sotomayor and others have said it needs to happen. But meanwhile, this is what came up in Ross's case to Supreme Court. They got his IP address through his email. Their claim of how they found his email to me is dubious. But in any case, they had it. They went to Comcast. They subpoenaed Comcast. Comcast gave them the IP address. Then they got the Meta information, and also were able to put a pen trap and trace on his router in his home, which once that happened, they were able to put it on a pen trap and trace on his actual computer, which essentially turned it into a tracking device. So he was being tracked on his computer, and all the activity anywhere in the world it could have happened without a warrant. And so they can track any of us. They can put, it's like putting a collar on a, you know, an animal. So they can track any of us this way, just using our computers. They also had a directional antenna aimed at his home without a warrant. So they could aim a directional antenna at your home. The government can do this, see what you're doing and all of that without a warrant, secretly, in a parked car across the street where you don't know who that is. This is really pushing it with the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment is supposed to protect us from this kind of thing. And because it's digital, it's this sort of area that has not been addressed in the courts. The courts are not keeping up with technology is what's happening. And so all of our privacy rights are being threatened or actually decimated.
Lynn, I want to add that not only are the courts not keeping up with technology, but judges across the nation, for the most part, are really technologically unsophisticated. A study showed that something like a majority of federal judges, and many of them are older, who've been on the bench,
right.
really have no exposure to technology.
Right.
And I think that was a huge factor in Ross's case, not only with the judge, possibly with the jury, and I hate to say it, with his defense attorney.
Yeah, I agree. In fact, more than half of the jury was over 40, and they weren't really his peers in the same sense that actual peers would have been able to understand the case so much better. I don't think they had a clue what Bitcoin, how it worked, and our witness wasn't allowed to testify to explain it. It's a whole new world out there. And those of us who are older, it's a big challenge to learn all of that. And you're right, it is the people running our country at those levels that they're not understanding it.
Lynn, we are out of time. This has really been a sobering discussion. One more time, tell our listeners how they can sign that petition for Ross.
Thank you. Just go to freeross.org, and there's a link right there, or freeross.org/petition will get you there, too. Thank you. That would be great. And if anyone out there has any connections to the White House or in Washington or politically at all, please get a hold of me. You can do that on freeross.org. Every footer has a way to contact us. I would really appreciate any help in that regard.
Lynn Ulbricht, you are just the best. You're a staunch advocate, and you've hung in there for all these years. Thank you for the update, and best wishes to you.
Thanks, Heidi.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
What is the attorney-client privilege, and to whom does it apply? Generally speaking, the privilege is owned by the client, and unless the client waived her rights, her lawyer is barred not only from revealing any information about the client, but even revealing who the client is. an exception in the case of the FBI raid in 2018 on Donald Trump's attorney's office, home, and hotel room was made on the grounds that there is a, quote, fraud exception to the attorney-client privilege. Defenders of the privilege, even if it has to do with protecting Donald Trump, have argued that it's illegal and unprincipled for the Justice Department to obtain a search warrant from a federal magistrate and violate that basic principle. They argue that making an exception could backfire. Today we're joined by Minneapolis attorney Carla Kjellberg, who's worked with victims of child sexual assault who have sued priests, litigated sensitive family matters, and worked with unions and political activists. Carla, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about the attorney-client privilege. What is it and who can assert it?
So the attorney-client privilege is, actually it's two things. The first thing it is an evidentiary rule that prohibits courts, tribunals, from requiring individuals who acted as an attorney to divulge information. It also is an ethical rule that applies to attorneys. So it's two things. In the context that we've been talking about it, it is an evidentiary rule that protects attorney-client communication. Now, it's actually kind of specific in who it applies to. So you need to be someone who has contacted a specific lawyer for a specific question. You know, that you've actually hired him or her to do something, to represent you in a specific manner. And if in that process you communicate something, that is protected by attorney-client privilege. It is owned by the client, not the lawyer.
Meaning the client is the one who can elect to violate it or not.
Correct, unless it falls under an exception that the court would not honor the privilege claim.
So do you believe that it was legal to raid Trump's attorney's office and his hotel room and his home and seize his files and the computer data that they got? What was your reaction to that?
I was actually okay with that, to be honest. I was not okay with the court requiring Cohen's lawyer to disclose the identity of his third client. But let's go back to the raid. But I don't have enough information, neither does anybody else. It is quite possible that they have effectively found that there was evidence that, and it would have to be President Trump, was using his relationship with Cohen to further a crime, to further fraud. Now, here we've got to trust the system, right? And that's always the question. Do we really trust the system? But the system is set in place where there has to be, a judge has to review specific factual allegations, and they have to be evidence that they already have. They can't go there for a fishing expedition. So if they did that, then I'm okay with it. And here's why. And I'm going to give you an example from Minnesota, that people have used the attorney-client privilege in order to create fraud for as long as the rule has been there. Now, what people talk about most is the mob cases, right? But I want to talk about something else that you and I would completely agree with. So here in Minnesota, the attorney general sued the tobacco industry for basically fraud. I mean, it's more technical than that, but it's basically you knew that this stuff was deadly, you knew how deadly it was, you knew how addictive it was, you lied to everybody, made a lot of money, and killed a lot of people. And one of the things that was talked about there is the fact that they knew how deadly it was and they knew how addictive it was, but they tried to keep that quiet and to themselves and not disclose it in discovery or in the court process. And how they did that is in all of their scientific research, they involved a lawyer. In every single part of it, the hiring of the research, the implementation of the research, they had the communications of all of that CC'd and in the presence of counsel. Now, you and I can both say that's fraud, right? We don't want attorney-client privilege to be able to cover that. So you asked me, was I upset about the raid? It is really important for us progressives to not sit here and just cheer, right? And not just say, oh my gosh, the FBI is coming to our rescue, the Justice Department is coming to our rescue, and they're gonna right all of this, right? We know that we can't trust that. So what really upset me is that the judge did not take the discretion she could with regard to allowing the disclosure of the third client in camera. So there's been a lot of conversation about is the fact that you have hired this particular lawyer, is the existence of the attorney-client privilege in itself privileged? Or the existence of the attorney-client relationship in itself privileged? And most courts will say no, that it's not, except there's some exceptions. The one is that the information would implicate the client in the very criminal activity for which the legal service was sought. So the identity of the client, the consequence of the client and attorney privilege. And the other one, and this one kind of covers the issue with Hannity, right? Another exception is when the disclosure of the client's identity would reveal the nature of the legal problem or personal confidential information about the client. So that one is what we were all, at least what I was upset about. I mean, everybody assumed, oh, it's Hannity. That means he paid somebody off, right? She could have used her discretion to do the responsible thing there, and she chose not to.
Carla, that leads me to a related topic, which is the duty to minimize the disclosure of confidential information. Can you briefly talk about that? I was just thinking that the information is made available, and is there a need to sort of sift through and only release what is absolutely necessary, say in a criminal case, to prove certain identities or that a case exists? Do they have to screen it?
Well, they have to screen it. It's a little different than what you laid out. They have to first identify that the only information, so yes, they have to screen it. The only information that they can release is information that goes to the question, did the client use the attorney in the furtherance of the commission of a crime or fraud? So there are cases where, I'm thinking of one in particular, where somebody who owned a company was trying to defraud his ex-wife or something like that, and he was transferring the company to somebody else. And the tax attorney made a email to the accountant saying, hey, from now on, don't do anything because I'm thinking of having the taxes done in Mr. Smith's name instead of Mr. Jones's name. And the court said, look, you don't, that's not enough. That's enough information to make you suspicious, but that's not enough to prove intent of the client. And that's what it comes back to, is intent of the client. Now, this is kind of interesting. I mean, you're right, that warrant was broad. We're talking about his home, his office, and his hotel room. That's kind of a different question with regard to, was the warrant appropriate? And we can only trust the system, and you and I both know how far we can usually trust the system, but did the prosecutors come with enough information to justify all of those warrants?
Let's speculate here. My suspicion is that if you want to get a magistrate to sign a search warrant, you have to show specifically what you're looking for. You can't do a fishing expedition. And my suspicion is that the stuff that they listed that they were looking for has to do with money laundering, has to do with racketeering, has to do with Trump and his attorney getting money from Russian oligarchs and laundering it for him to build the kind of projects that Trump builds. And that's what I think was probably in the papers to get the warrant. What's your thinking on that?
Well, I think that, and I also think that they handed them such an easy opening. I mean, this whole thing about Stormy Daniels, and I can't remember the timeline here, but this happened right after President Trump said, "I don't know anything about that. You'll have to ask my lawyer." Or I don't know if he said my lawyer or Michael Cohen. And his statement there completely eliminated his attorney-client privilege.
Yes.
Because in order for attorney-client privilege to be appropriate, you have to actually have the client consciously and purposely engage the lawyer for a specific legal purpose. And he just said, "I don't know anything about it," so there's no attorney-client privilege. Now, we all suspect that he's not telling the truth, but certainly that's enough to allow for a warrant for that. And then you have the bonus of getting all the other things that could be associated with that kind of fraud.
So let's look at the other side of this. I spoke with a friend of mine who had one time been the head of the New York State Trial Lawyers Association night before last, and I asked him what his reaction was, because I was curious. You know, our mutual friend Catherine Franke, who is the chairwoman of the board of the Center for Constitutional Rights, her initial reaction was, this could be dangerous, this could backfire. We don't want to do the principle of any stick will do to beat a dog when we're going after Trump. And that was the same kind of reaction that my friend from the Trial Lawyers Association said. He said, you know, this may not be good. It may be that the camel's nose is under the tent. Did you have that kind of ambiguous reaction when you first heard about the raid?
Not about the raid. I had it, and maybe I was too much of a cheerleader, you know, and I admit that. I had it about the disclosure of the Hannity as the client. That made me very concerned. And it reminded me of just what Catherine is worried about and what your friend is worried about, is that we can't be those people. We can't be those people that bend our cheerleading for a certain action of the government or the authority, depending on who's in. I mean, the rule of law is all we have to control our democracy, or to not control our democracy, to maintain our democracy. And that's what we've seen slip away, is the rule of law and the respect for the systems that we've put in place. So I was just making an assumption, well, boy, they must have had something. But what made me really worry is, and this is what I thought the judge was doing, it was almost gratuitous. And I really didn't like that. That's where I thought, okay, we have to pay attention to the fact that these rules have to apply to everybody equally. Because, yeah, in those circumstances, that's exactly the exception I read about. I mean, everybody jumped to a fixer fixing a affair or whatever.
What scares all of us is you have the massive power of the government, of the state, and it can be mobilized against one powerless individual in a criminal prosecution. And all right. that individual has really got going for him or her is they've got an attorney. And they have to trust that attorney, and they have to know that whatever they say to that attorney is between the two of them. And, right. And you know, we have a couple of friends who went to jail because of the attorney-client privilege.
Absolutely misused. And we are in, politically, we are in such an awkward position. As progressives, we are watching, you know, one branch of the federal government, which we have distrusted with good reason for a century, try to stop us from jumping completely off the cliff into fascism. Now, it's not certainly not their total responsibility, but so I'm agreeing with you. We can't allow that feeling of, oh, man, the FBI is on our side this time. Holy, okay, we'll be okay. We can't lie there. But on the other hand, I'm going to poke you a little bit with the attorney-client privilege. We also have to recognize that the attorney-client privilege historically has been used to protect fraud and criminal activity. And I gave you the example of the tobacco litigation, but most notably it is the organized crime. You know, that the consigliere would say, I am so-and-so's lawyer. Nothing they have said to me, I can tell you, because it's protected by attorney-client privilege. And so that's where the law came with regard to the exception of the attorney-client privilege. Well, that's not appropriate. It has to be a specific, at least that's what they argued, that you can't have all of the information. It has to be specific to the what you're hiring the lawyer for.
Well, this is all going to come out in the wash.
But as leftists, Catherine is right. I mean, we have to always question the use of federal power, no matter where it is, no matter if it makes us happy in one instance, and we cannot apply different rules depending on what side we're on.
This has been a very good discussion. Thank you so much from speaking with us from your legal office out there in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and we wish you well. You take it easy.
I will. Fight the good fight, guys.
Thanks,
Talk
Carla.
To you some other time.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.